I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. We've all heard how the human genome is a map that might have the answers to tracking how some diseases are passed through generations of families. Now, researchers at Children's Mercy Hospital have found a way to chart that map closer to the speed of a GPS than an old-fashioned cartographer. We'll talk about how that innovation is helping children and take a look at the genome research at Washington University in St. Louis and the application it might have for treating one of society's most talked-about diseases, cancer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Every year, Time Magazine ranks the top 10 medical breakthroughs for 2012. Number 7 for 2012, a technology developed at Children's Mercy Hospital known as fast sequencing. Fast sequencing is a way to speed up the diagnosis of critically ill infants with genetic diseases. In the past, such diagnosis using genome sequencing has taken a lot of time, and it's been too costly and complex to have much real-world application. No more, thanks to the Children's Mercy Hospital breakthrough. Also today, genetic breakthroughs in breast cancer research driven by incredible advances in our understanding of the human genome. With us today, Dr. Stephen Kingsmore. He's director of the Center for Pediatric Genomic Medicine at Children's Mercy. Dr. Kingsmore, so nice to have you.
Thanks very much.
Happy New Year. Dr. Matthew Ellis is also with us. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine, the Oncology Division at Washington University in St. Louis. Dr. Ellis, good morning to you as well.
And good morning to you and your audience.
Dr. Kingsmore, the bottom line here with the breakthrough you've helped bring forth basically comes down to a single word, which is speed. This genome testing that once was done took several weeks. At Children's Mercy, you can now do that in a matter of about 50 hours. Why is that speed so important?
Yeah, it's really important because about 1 in 20 babies is born with a genetic illness or I beg your pardon. 1 in 20 babies is admitted to an intensive care unit. Many of these babies are not predictable. And so when they're born, it's an emergency to figure out what's going on.
And time is important. Time is of the essence.
Time is critical. Basically, a physician is confronted with a bewildering number of possibilities, and a healthy proportion of these babies have a genetic illness. That's a defect in their DNA code that's causing their illness.
And at the time, you can't tell what's troubling a particular infant, if I understand right.
That's correct. Just the fact that it's a brand new baby means that quite often the illnesses are not well differentiated. They look quite similar.
And 1 in 20 newborns has some sort of genetic disease?
No, I flubbed that one.
Okay.
it's a Monday morning.
Believe me.
1 in 20 babies has an emergency and requires admission to an intensive care unit. Of those, maybe a third to a quarter are associated with genetic disorders.
So how do you do the test? Say you have a troubled newborn in front of you. What do you do?
Well, this test that we developed is still a research test, so we have to get the parents' permission, but we get a small blood sample. We, in that sample, remove the DNA. That's the code of life. It's about 3 billion letters long, and our process
is
3 billion letters.
Which means?
Which means that it's the equivalent of about 100 New York phone books piled on top of one another. And this is the code of life. It encodes all the instructions for human life. And somewhere in that, in these babies, is a mistake, what we call a mutation, which is leading to their illness. And so what we have to do is to sift through that information, and we've been able to do that in about 50 hours and return a result to the baby's physician.
Now, excuse an impertinent question here, given how Time Magazine has recognized what you've done. I recognize that what you're talking about here is enormously complex. In this computer age that we are now immersed in, why does it still take 50 hours? I know that's a huge advancement from where it was, but why still 50 hours?
Well, I think it's very difficult to understand how big the genome is. You have to remember that the first time a human genome was decoded, it took a couple of decades. And so the idea of doing this in 2 days is somewhat unthinkable. About half of that time is doing chemistry, where we actually get the sequence, the coding material, and the other half is for computers to analyze that and figure out where in the genome is a mistake that causes a baby's illness.
And once you've run this test, how narrowly can you then confine your search? Do you know exactly what's troubling the newborn, or is it still a range of possibilities?
That really depends on the individual baby. If they have a genetic illness associated with a specific region of the genome, then that's definitive. That gives us a singular cause of their disease. If we don't see something, then there's still a range of possibilities.
One other big question before I bring Dr. Ellis into our conversation. Once you do this test, doctor, do you also determine that any particular newborn might be susceptible at some point down the road to one type of cancer or another, or one type of heart ailment or another? Can you glean that much information from what you're doing?
Well, one of the critical things that our work has done that's quite different from other groups is to only analyze the pieces of the genome that are relevant for a baby's illness. There are a lot of ethical concerns in a newborn baby in terms of finding things that are not really relevant to the baby's illness. And so that's one of the key things we've done. The information is possible to be gleaned, but really at that time, it's not relevant.
You're narrowing your search to what's right in front
exactly.
of you at the time.
Yes, yeah. That's right.
Okay. But in theory, you could go beyond that and find out all kinds of things about this newborn, what the future might hold for that newborn.
Yes, it's just that that's an ethical problem that really for a physician or a family, they're confronted with an acutely ill baby. They need to get a diagnosis, and something that might affect them in adulthood is really something that we don't want to know.
At that time, at least.
At that
anyway.
Time.
Yeah. Well, Dr. Ellis, let me bring you into our conversation here. Your work at Washington University in St. Louis involves a fundamental shift in our understanding of breast cancer, again, using genetic research. You've helped identify 4 genetically distinct types of breast cancer. The New York Times reported that you've found the hallmark genetic change that are actually driving those cancers. What does that mean, that you've found the genetic changes that are driving those cancers? Translate that for me.
I'll do my best. these genetic changes are very distinct from the ones that were just being discussed in the context of pediatrics and newborn children. Obviously, we're born with the DNA we inherit from mum and dad. And unfortunately, over time in growing cells, that DNA gets corrupted over time. In a sense, it's a natural aging process. So as adults, we've got cells growing in our bodies which are not exactly the same in terms of their genetics as the cells we were born with. Hmm. They've accumulated errors over time, essentially.
Right.
And that's what causes cancer, the accumulation of these errors. And every time a cell divides, a bit like spinning a roulette wheel, you hope that little ball, goes in the roulette sense, to the right place to score a jackpot. Unfortunately, in cancer, it's the opposite problem. You hope that ball doesn't fall into a critical place in the genome which alters cellular functions and drives them towards cancer.
But it happens sometimes, obviously.
Well, of course, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
So what the sort of research we've been doing requires us to therefore sequence the normal DNA, which we get from a blood draw, the DNA, if you mm-hmm. like, circulating cells, And then we compare the DNA sequence with DNA extracted from the patient's breast cancer. And then we contrast the two to look for all the changes associated with the development of that particular breast cancer.
I think I want to stop the conversation now and thank you both for speaking so practically and at a seventh grade level. So I'm following this conversation. I was nervous walking in the door here, and you're doing such a great job, both of you. You know, Dr. Ellis, you have said that this is a pretty big deal. This actually could be the roadmap for curing breast cancer. That means, obviously, we're talking about a pretty big deal here.
Well, I think it's the beginning of a cure, but I think the data tells us, and this was pretty obvious if you look after breast cancer patients, is that the disease is very heterogeneous. That is to say, the breast cancer behaves very differently in different women, and you can see that heterogeneity at the genetic level. And so what we're doing is comparing the life stories of the patients and their breast cancer with the genetic information and matching the two up. And we've been doing this for about a decade with various techniques of increasing sophistication and developing, if you like, diagnostic paradigms and looking for clues as to how to treat patients, not as a group, but on an individual basis. Because clearly what we're finding is that future medicine looks like you're going to have to do some kind of sophisticated analysis of a patient's breast cancer and then choose from a sort of smorgasbord of treatments, if you like, to get the balance of risks and benefits and efficacy right.
And Dr. Ellis, I gather that the future of medicine also would suggest that at some point down the road, when I go in for a routine physical exam, that my doctor is going to have all kinds of DNA information on my chart right in front of him.
Yes, maybe. But I think some earlier comments are very pertinent here. A lot of this information, we don't know exactly what it means yet. And so the only thing that should be appearing on the doctor's chart are things that we know about the biology, and they are ethically actionable, right? And so, you know, this is a very fast-moving world, and some of the concerns right now is that information sort of gets out there, which will confuse patients and doctors. And so increasingly, you know, we're trying to address that by making sure there's a regulated environment so that only well-annotated material gets into the chart and it's clearly linked to an improvement in a patient's outcome or ability to predict a future cancer or something like that.
Now, Dr. Ellis, a couple of minutes ago you were saying that this is the beginning steps on the road for actually finding a cure for breast cancer. You know, folks listening to this, struggling with cancer of one kind or another, and my own family, we've had our own experiences with breast cancer. What is the prognosis looking ahead for when it comes to finding a cure for these common types of cancers? How many years? People want to know.
Well, I think it'll be many years before there's a cure for everybody, but let me just tell you a brief story, which I think is illustrative of the way the field's going. So about mid-year, we had data on about 1,500 sequenced breast cancers, which is a pretty huge number. Basically, as we trawled through this data looking for clues as to how to treat patients, we found that 1.6% of patients had a mutation in a gene called HER2. Now, we've known about this gene HER2 for many years, and there's successful treatments that target this protein that have really altered the lives of many breast cancer patients. But those treatments only work when the cell is making massive amounts of the protein. The lingo is that the gene is amplified and overexpressed. But we found these mutations in tumors that didn't have that overexpression. These mutations had subtly altered the code of the gene and activated without the cell making huge quantities of it. And we've now started a clinical trial where we go searching for these patients, and then when we find them, we give them a precise medicine which we think will help them. Obviously, we don't know that. It's a clinical trial. But the point is that 1.6% of breast cancer doesn't sound like many, but because the denominator is so huge, you know, millions, over a million women get breast cancer a year, over 300,000 in the United States, it turns out that the HER2 mutant population is as big as some of the diseases we think of as major successes in oncology, like the treatment of chronic myeloid leukemia, for example. So, you know, I think what will happen is the cure for breast cancer will occur in small subset, followed by small subset, followed by small subset. So if you have, you like, inverted commas, the right type of breast cancer, there are cures available today. If you have the wrong sort, and we haven't quite worked it out yet, well, the best thing is to go into a clinical trial or participate in some of these studies.
So we're talking about steps, small steps in many cases that eventually might lead to something sweeping.
Small groups, which together make a sweep. But think of it, maybe there's another analogy I like to use. You know, you go to a doctor and he says you have anemia, right? Well, anemia is not a diagnosis. It's just a symptom complex. You're not making enough hemoglobin, or your red cells are being destroyed, and a whole host of possibilities as to why your hemoglobin is low. And so the first thing the hematologist does is say, well, okay, your blood count's not looking great. Why is that? And when he works out why it is, he'll give you the right medicine. It might be something very simple, like, you know, a dose of iron. It might be something very complicated, like, hey, you know, you need gene therapy for alpha thalassemia or some genetic illness. And breast cancer is exactly the same. I mean, you know, it's a symptom complex. Abnormal cells from the breast epithelium growing in the wrong place in the breast, and then hence to other parts of the body. But unless we know why those cells are behaving that way, unless we can pinpoint the genetic changes, we won't know really how to precisely treat that patient. And so we're sort of learning how to be clever hematologists, in a sense, you know, and we're just at the beginning of that. But, you know, it's a new world.
If you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about some breathtaking advances through genetic research. We're talking about the diagnosis of critically ill infants at speeds far greater than ever before at Children's Mercy, and breathtaking advances in breast cancer research over at Washington University in St. Louis. We're visiting with Dr. Stephen Kingsmore from Children's Mercy, Dr. Matthew Ellis from Washington University in St. Louis. Have you had genetic testing done on yourself or a family member? What did you find out? And are you worried about finding out about some condition or disease you might develop in the future and what that might mean for you? Our phone number here, 816-235-2888. Our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Dr. Kingsmore, put our conversation today in a little more context. I gather what we're talking about here as we talk about these breathtaking advances in our understanding of the human genome, you know, is this roadmap of human genetic information that's being developed. Just how far along in the process are we, and what sort of lies ahead here?
Well, I think Matthew has talked a little bit about cancer. Cancer is a very complicated genetic disease. The diseases we're dealing with predominantly in children are very simple genetic diseases. And so a single point in
the
genome...
Because they're so young.
Well, they're young, and that
means
that...
And the genes haven't mutated yet.
Yes. What we're dealing with in children are things that they've inherited from mom and dad. And very often, mom and dad have mistakes in their genome. In fact, all of us do. But they're at different sites. And you need a combination of those to result in illness. So mom and dad look normal. They are normal. But when they have a baby, there's a certain chance that that baby will have the disease. And so in this situation, which is very common in children, the genetics is quite simple. There are about 3,500 such diseases, and if we add them all together, they affect several percent of children. The tricky bit for physicians up until now has been that it's been impossible to sift through 3,500 different diseases to find out which particular one it is in a given child. Just as Matthew spoke about with anemia, this is very similar in genetic diseases in children.
But in simplest terms, Dr. Kingsmore, what we're talking about is we've now laid out the human genome. We're learning how to use the information that we've gleaned from that process, right?
Yes, I think the thing which I'm most excited about is this concept that instead of just looking at one place in the genome, which is how we've done this in the past, and then in a given patient or child, we have to do this iteratively, one space after one space, and that process can take months or years. Sometimes, tragically, a second affected child is born while the first child has not been diagnosed. So the difference in what we're doing is to survey the entire genome, this 3 billion letter code, all at once, and to do that in a few days, which gives a somewhat instant diagnosis, as opposed to this tremendously frustrating process that's taken months or years.
Can you walk us through an infant you've had at Children's Mercy and how that process worked for that infant in terms of helping him or her get treated for what ailed them?
Yes, I can. We recently had two brothers who had the same type of disease. It's called...
Twins?
Not twins, two mm-hmm. brothers. Mm-hmm. One was older, the other younger. And they both had very early onset of inflammatory bowel disease. This is where the colon, the intestines, are inflamed. And in these particular boys, this was extremely severe, of very early onset, and refractory to the treatments which normally control that disease. And so we were able to perform this type of analysis, surveying most of the genome in both boys and mum and dad, and we found a single place in the genome in each of the boys that contained the mutation that caused their disease. Now, what was amazing about this case was that it was possible to give the boys a bone marrow transplant, potentially, and give them a cure.
And has that happened?
So one of the boys was admitted to hospital late last year, and in fact received a bone marrow transplant. It's really early after that. And so we will find out whether that has cured him. And there's another brother. The whole team at Children's Mercy is monitoring them very closely. Mm-hmm. But this is a very exciting type of case. There have been several other reported from other medical centers where these types of tests are really giving doctors new tools to treat genetic illnesses.
Let's go to some phone calls, 816-235-2888. Let's go to Mike from Kansas City, Missouri. Mike, good morning.
Yes, I'm referring to the doctor from St. Louis that made a use of term, and maybe it's a mutation. And my question is, do mutations occur... maybe it occurs both places when I get to my question. Is the mutation caused by the mixing of the female and the male, or did I think you used a term and I don't remember what it was? But the mutation happened because I think you said something like something wears out or something gets corrupted.
Yeah.
Or something. I don't remember what your term is.
Mike, I'm going to put you on hold, so hang on with us. Dr. Matthew Ellis, help Mike out here.
Okay, so we're talking about two different types of genetic diseases here. So there's the genetic diseases you can get at the time that you're conceived. In other words, you've got a damaged gene that you inherit from mum or a damaged gene you inherit from dad. And in these pediatric conditions, both parents have a damaged gene, and you're sort of getting away with it very often because you've got a normal copy. But when you get together at the time of conception, the child is unfortunate enough to have two copies of the damaged gene, one from each parent. So that's so-called inherited illnesses. Cancer can be caused by those types of events where the mutation goes on to trigger a cancer later in life, the mutation you inherit. But most of cancer is not thought to be due to that kind of genetic abnormality. It's essentially a disease of aging, where as we get older, the genetic material in our cells, as it's replicated is the term, but as it's copied from one cell to another, those copies have a finite chance of actually containing an error. And indeed, probably an error occurs with every cell division. Now, we get away with it because the human genome is so huge. But if you're unlucky enough for that error to occur in a crucial part of the genome, a cancer can be triggered. And so the rate in which those mutations accumulate is variable. And certainly if patients are doing something like smoking, for example, the rate of accumulation of mutations is much higher. than a non-smoker. So they have a higher incidence of these kinds of cancers, which are induced by these accumulation of errors over time. Does that answer your question?
Mike,
yes.
What do you...
Yes, and let me mention the basis of my conversation. My question was, I'm going to get religious for just a second. I don't think God sits down and says, okay, I've got 10,000 people here, and there's supposed to be X number of this cancer and this, and there and X number on this and this, and he goes zap, zap, zap. So, I'm glad your question. I mean, your answer's been very helpful because I don't blame God for problems.
Yeah.
So, anyways, thank you, and I'm going to shut up.
Thank you for the phone call. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation about these breathtaking advances in genetic research. We'll talk about kids and infants and what genetic testing might tell us about their futures in terms of their propensity for developing cancers or heart problems down the road and the ethical ramifications of all of that. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed Friday's conversation about how the law applies to superheroes and our prediction of this year's job market, you can find those and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. On tomorrow's program, we'll look at one doctor's view of how children might be over-medicated, and we'll take a stroll through a rustic life spent in a Flint Hills cabin. This hour, we're talking about breathtaking genetic breakthroughs on the breast cancer front and with infants, and faster ways to diagnose what ails a young baby. We're visiting today with Dr. Stephen Kingsmore. He's director of the Center for Pediatric Genomic Medicine at Children's Mercy, and Dr. Matthew Ellis. He's a professor in the Department of Medicine, the Oncology Division at WashU over in St. Louis. Dr. Kingsmore, how did you react when Time Magazine ranked your work as one of the top 10 medical breakthroughs of 2012?
I was somewhat surprised.
Were you?
I didn't think we were that smart. So it was pretty exciting.
What does something like that mean for your program at Children's Mercy when you receive a national dose of publicity like that?
I think it's very important. I think in some ways Children's Mercy Hospital is one of the best protected secrets in the city.
Hmm.
And I think it's about time that we got a little bit of publicity for the research we do. So I was really glad about that.
Well, as a dad with personal experience with Children's Mercy with my firstborn, I can attest to very much of what you're saying. You know, Dr. Ellis, I'm just wondering how close we are in our medicine these days to having babies diagnosed, having even older folks diagnosed through genetic research, to what kinds of ailments might lie in front of them in the years to come, finding out if a two-year-old might be a good candidate for cancer down the road or heart ailments, that kind of thing. Where are we with all that right now?
Well, I think it's important to distinguish, again, a couple of things. You know, one is... the dramatic research where, you know, you're going to repair a single gene defect,
mm-hmm,
by a bone marrow transplant, was mentioned earlier, or other very sophisticated techniques. But very often, when we're doing genetic research, we're not really contemplating that. What we're looking at is a genetic change that's increases your risk. Sometimes, not even dramatically, but modestly, these are things that are called SNPs, for example. They're sort of mysterious changes in the genome that put people at risk for diseases like cancer, diabetes, and heart disease. And the thing about these are that the physician might say to that individual, look, you are from higher risk, very often these individuals may have a family history, which is also a pretty good clue that there's a gene in the family.
Mm-hmm.
You need to work harder on lifestyle changes and be careful about your diet. And the concept here, I think, is that you can escape your genotype by lifestyle modification. So, for example, if you had a predisposition to adult onset diabetes, you would really want to work hard and on the right diet and the right level of mm-hmm. physical activity, for example, and also monitoring, so that if you do develop the problem, it can be treated early, and early treatment of things like diabetes or indeed cancer can lead you to escape the worst consequences of it.
I guess I'm wondering, Dr. Kingsmore, are we at a point where a doctor like you can take a newborn through the testing you're doing and find out, what might lie ahead for a particular baby, and what do you do with that information?
Well, there are several things. So when a baby is born acutely ill, obviously there's this rush to make a diagnosis, a specific diagnosis, and to then provide an appropriate treatment. But then in addition to that sort of emergency situation, in other children with diseases, they're not quite so acute. The family wants to know what the future looks like. What's the prognosis? Will the child grow up? Will it have a normal life? And how can we modify the disease in addition to traditional treatments to improve the quality of life for the child and to give the family the tools to be able to cope? And so in that way, we are looking forward to what future life looks like besides the snapshot of what's going on today and what we need to do today in terms of treatment.
And what can you tell from the testing you're doing? How much into the future can you foresee these days?
Well, it very much depends on the illness. And so for some illnesses that are very well understood, like, say, cystic fibrosis, which is a lung disease that's fairly common in folk who have their ancestry from Northern Europe, such testing can give us an indication of how rapidly that disease might get worse, and it can also give us specific information in terms of a treatment that will work very effectively in an individual and not in another.
Can you tell by looking at an infant that this baby in 20 or 30 years might be a prime candidate to develop one cancer or another?
Well, as I said earlier, mm-hmm. this is a big ethical question.
Yeah.
And if you think about it, a baby is not participating in that decision. The baby can't. And often the parents really struggle as well. These are very complicated questions.
But and you can tell, though, as a doctor?
Well, one of the things that we're doing is to prevent that type of dilemma. And so what we're able to do at Children's Mercy is to plug in the symptoms and signs that are bothering a baby at a given time,
or a child. So you're narrowing the search down.
Exactly. And so we blank out the rest of the genome. It never emerges from our computers, and that's for a very specific reason. The physicians, the family, and the child, we believe, don't want to know about those other things. They want to know what's relevant for that particular visit with their physician.
But what if a rich person comes in and has a baby and says, I want to know, my baby's fine right now, but I want to know what might lie ahead for this child. Run your test, doctor, and tell me what the future is.
We would refer them somewhere else. We're a children's hospital,
mm-hmm.
and so our business is healing kids and giving families information in terms of what the future holds if they have additional children. So we really wouldn't be the right candidate for somebody who wants to do, an intellectual exercise looking into the future.
Yeah. Now, Dr. Kingsmore, I'm wondering, when you do your fast sequencing we were talking about in our first half, this new technology at Children's Mercy Hospital that speeds up a diagnosis of a critically ill infant, when you get the result back, and maybe it's bad news for the infant, obviously bad news for the parents, how do you deal with that? How do you talk to a parent about information like that? How do you break that news to mom or dad?
Well, let me just say, I mean, it's a very good question. Let me just say that I'm mainly a researcher, but I do talk a lot to the guys who look after these babies, the neonatologists, and they've told me something that I would never have guessed and seems a little bit counterintuitive, and that is that giving parents an answer and giving their physicians an answer, even if the answer is the baby will die, is phenomenally useful and very helpful for the whole team. It means that decisions can be made sort of proactively in terms of how far to go. At what point are we just prolonging the suffering of the baby and the family and wasting, you know, healthcare dollars? And it allows families to start to participate in that decision and to do very practical things like let the family know, start a grieving process, have the last rites performed, mm-hmm. you know, those sorts of things which make a huge, huge difference in terms of how you cope with such a tragic situation.
Again, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR, and we're talking about genetic advances in research, and we're wondering, have you had genetic testing done on yourself or a family member, and how did that go for you? 816-235-2888 is our phone number, our email address, uptodate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Dr. Ellis, coming from to us from Washington University over in St. Louis, the study you're involved with is part of a large federal project known as the Cancer Genome Atlas. What is the Cancer Genome Atlas?
Well, a few years ago, the National Cancer Institute, recognizing the new technology in genome sequencing became available, and recognizing, of course, that cancer, in a sense, is the quintessential genetic disease, they set out to map or identify all the genetic changes that are occurring in a wide variety of cancers. And so there's Atlas projects in lung cancer and breast cancer and ovarian cancer and head and neck cancer, et cetera, leukemia. And the idea is then we take this information where hundreds of tumors have been analyzed, and take it forward, into laboratories that are capable of extracting the medical value from the information. And the thing about the Atlas, it's not just sequencing-based. We're looking at other aspects of the cancer cell, and I think this is going to be increasingly important. And there's ongoing investments at the National Cancer Institute to look at not only the DNA and the RNA, but indeed also the protein abnormalities in cancer cells.
And you're looking at not just breast cancer, right, Dr. Ellis? You're looking at all kinds of cancers here, right?
Yeah, and in fact, this is one of our findings in the middle of last year, is it allows you to look at across cancers and ask the question, well, yes, I know this cancer arose in the breast, but does it have any similarities with a cancer that arose somewhere else in the body? And in fact, one of the more interesting things, I think, on our analysis that was done on a variety of different looks at, you know, DNA, RNA, and protein, was that certain forms of breast cancer are very similar to certain forms of ovarian cancer, a very clear link. And so that's led to some thinking about how we can perhaps learn from the treatment of ovarian cancer when we're treating breast cancer. And so something as straightforward as that can actually lead to a lot of interesting clinical hypotheses about treatment.
So I'm guessing, Dr. Ellis, that at this point in your career, this must be a pretty exciting time, given how the pace seems to be picking up on the whole genome front and applications and research just moving at an ever-accelerating clip. At least that's the impression I'm getting sitting here today.
I think that is true. It is a very exciting time. But as with all sort of transition periods in medicine, we have to do things in a systematic way, and sometimes that's frustrating to patients. But, you know, there's potential for harm as well as good from the information interpretation. So, here's a good example. You know, there's a mutation in a breast cancer that is related or similar to a mutation that occurs in a melanoma. In melanoma, mm-hmm. it's common, and in breast cancer, it's uncommon. But the drug that targets that mutation is only approved in melanoma. But the breast cancer patient says, well, I want it too. But the problem there is the insurance company wouldn't reimburse it because there's no indication in the label for breast cancer, and the drug costs $5,000 or $10,000 a month. So what do you end up doing? you know, you'd mortgage your house to get the drug. The answer is that there needs to be a clinical trial. In that particular case, there's a clinical trial that's available for patients with this mutation, regardless of which cancer was sequenced. So even if it was a colon cancer, if it had the melanoma-type mutation, you could get the drug through the clinical trial. So I think the key thing is to emphasize the importance of clinical trial medicine and patient volunteers and the advocacy community all working together with academic institutions and physicians interested in research oncology and industry to do the right thing, which is to do a sort of systematic research approach which balances all the risks and benefits and sets us up for the future.
But boy, Dr. Ellis, I can only imagine how difficult it would be to look someone in the eye and say, you know, you can't have this drug that works on melanoma. Your situation's different. We haven't done any trials on that yet, and you've got to wait. And boy, that's got to be tough.
It is tough, and I think it's going to get increasingly tough because, you know, we're in danger, in a sense, of tripping over ourselves. But I think there is a great willingness on the National Cancer Institute's part and our part and industry's part to try and get this right. I think that I'm optimistic that we'll be able to solve the logistical problems here and deliver valuable things to patients fairly rapidly.
Let's go back to some phone calls at 816-235-2888. Our topic today, genetic breakthroughs on all sorts of fronts. Marcy from Independence, good morning.
Good morning.
Go ahead, Marcy.
Sure. Well, I just wanted to make a comment that sometimes as a parent, and I'm a parent of a 14-year-old with special needs who's gone through all of the genetic testing for our son, sometimes for parents it's okay not to know what the genetic disorder is or the syndrome, and that was the case with ours. We don't know what his diagnosis is, but in many ways that has allowed us to treat him like his other brothers, and to not have a sense of dread or doom for the future. And so while we were early on very interested in knowing what his genetic syndrome was, we've sort of come to peace with that at 14 years down the road and not knowing. He's treated just like his other brothers as much as we can, and we deal with his symptoms as they come up.
Marcy, how did you decide not to find out? And when did that occur in the 14-year history of your son?
Well, I don't think we actually decided not to find out. There just simply wasn't an answer. We've taken him through genetics clinic at Children's Mercy, and he's been back for follow-ups, and they simply have never matched his symptoms up with a particular genetic syndrome. So we've dealt with the different issues he's had medically and developmentally as he's grown up, and just sort of had to come to peace with the notion that we might never find out, and then at that point said, you know, that's okay, because we had a doctor early on that thought it was a particular syndrome and said, buy a wheelchair now, he'll probably never walk. Well, he walks, he plays, he talks, he reads. He's significantly delayed, but if we had decided early on what his potential would be, we might have limited what he could become.
Hmm. I'm wondering, Dr. Kingsmore, how often do parents not find out for one reason or another?
Well, I think it's awesome that Marcy has come to peace. I mean, that's fantastic. In many families, that's not the case, and parents are looking for answers and get very frustrated. And in fact, most diseases don't get that definitive diagnosis because there are so many diseases, and because many of those diseases have been regarded as things which are not solvable. And so many categories of disease are put in a box where we have a symptomatic descriptor of them, but we don't know the molecular basis. And so the very exciting thing for guys like me is to start to be able to get into those diseases and to find out what is the definitive cause. For sure, we can't do it all the time, but with these new tests, we're able to do more and more of that. And in some of the cases, that can imply a treatment which had not been considered. And so that's what's very exciting. It's not a crystal ball that always gives an answer, but each year, I think, with these new technologies, we're offering new hope.
You know, Dr. Kingsmore, this fast sequencing that we've been talking about with you this morning at Children's Mercy, this way to speed up the diagnosis of critically ill infants with one genetic disease or another, what do those tests cost? And do insurance companies tend to cover them or not?
Well, this is very similar to Matthew's answer a couple of minutes ago about how do we turn this information into treatments which are paid for by insurance. And so we have the same issue with babies and children, which is that insurance companies really are in the business of usually keeping their costs down. And new tests cost money. One of the fantastic things here in Kansas City is that several individuals in the community have stepped up and given us donations to allow us to do free testing for hundreds of children. And as Matthew mentioned, that type of experience then allows us to collect the evidence to show an insurance company that this is in their best interest. This could save money.
So you're still at a point where you need to collect more evidence to make that case to the insurers that, hey, this is the way to go.
Absolutely. So what we made Time Magazine with was really what we'd call a proof of concept. It was really only 8 families. And now what we need to do is to test hundreds of families and show that this makes a practical difference in those children's lives.
Do you have a sense of what this test would cost right now?
Well, we have several tests. We have very limited testing, which is for specific conditions, all the way up to this emergency genome. And so the test that we've just developed for about 500 diseases is going to cost about $3,000. To do an emergency genome is really expensive. We think it's going to be about $13,000.
This is the 50-hour test we've been talking
exactly,
about.
Exactly, yes.
So $13,000 for
yes,
that.
Yes, it's right on the edge of what's technologically possible, and so it's pretty costly.
You know, I asked Dr. Ellis this question a few minutes ago, Dr. Ellis from WashU over in St. Louis, this idea that this is such a fast pace, fast-moving time in your world of genetic research. How exciting is it for you, Dr. Kingsmore, in terms of where you're at with your career and when you look out at what's happening around the world?
Well, what your listeners can't see is that I'm pretty gray-haired, and so this is an important time to take stock of my career, and really this is the most exciting thing I've ever encountered. I've been doing this type of research most of my adult life, and just 2 years ago, me and my team moved from a basic research institute because we were convinced that medicine was going to fundamentally change as we're able to provide genome information. And so we took this major risk, we changed careers, and we joined a children's hospital. And now it's really gratifying to see the first evidence that that's panning out, that indeed we're changing children's medicine.
Hmm. You know, Dr. Ellis, I'm wondering about the business applications of genome sequencing. What are we seeing happening on that front?
Well, a lot of activity is the bottom line, but a lot of regulatory confusion, which I think is creating some barriers. From a business perspective, there are sort of two types of testing environment that is covered by the FDA. There's something called a laboratory-based test, where basically a single lab can develop an assay, and then it's covered by various regulations to do with the quality of the lab. And then there's a whole set of regulatory approaches to generate what's called a distributed test, where you know, you have a machine, it's built to very high quality, you know, a bit like an aeroplane, and to go with that machine, you've got testing kits, and that would be a sort of distributed model. And most of the testing right now is in the former single laboratory type setting, but I think where we'll be in the future is that laboratories will be able to take in the right type of machine whose, you know, performance quality has been approved by the regulatory authorities, and then there'll be a kit, and you put the two together, and it'll spit out a result at the back of the machine. And we're beginning to see that in cancer, and I think we'll begin to see that in diagnostics in general, because obviously these are diseases that are, you know, daily occurrences in hospitals, and a single-site lab wouldn't be sufficient. So really the business models are trying to deal with those two realities, and I think the you know, there's a huge amount of life sciences investment going into this area right now.
Dr. Kingsmore, just a few seconds left here. Look into the future for us. We may not have believed 20 years ago that we'd be able to search the world's information from a computer on our desktop or even a phone in our pocket. In 20 years, will we be able to purchase a device at Walgreens that does instant home genetic testing that will tell us what we should be on the lookout for?
I mean, I really hope not, Steve, because I'm worried because, you know, traditionally we've needed physicians to really help us and guide us. And so my dream is that we'll be able to get a genome instantly when you see a physician, but that will be part of mainstream medicine. And I think that's really important. That's really why I joined a children's hospital, is I didn't want to see this be a consumer test. I just felt that could lead to chaos and confusion.
Dr. Ellis, you feel the same way?
I think so. I mean, I think that we have actually quite a good regulatory environment for this kind of thing. Obviously, it needs to be re-engineered, probably, you know, it needs to be speeded up, etc. But I think that you know, with all tests, there's potential for harm and there's a potential for error. And you could imagine that, you know, if you got the diagnosis wrong in one of Dr. Kingsmore's cases, you know, and you say to the family that, well, you know, your baby's going to die and the diagnosis is wrong and the baby's not going to die.
Right.
You know, you can imagine all sorts of difficulties. So we have to, you know, we have to do things the right, rigorous, scientific way. And I think the other point that Dr. Kingsmore is making is the counseling piece, is that, you know, just receiving naked information without a context,
yeah,
without a knowledge tree of the disease will lead to people, you know, to make all sorts of you know, decisions that could damage their lives. You know, you can imagine prophylactic surgeries and things in patients who aren't actually at risk,
right,
for particularly for breast cancer, for example. So I think that, you know, we need to emphasize the partnership piece. Yeah.
We'll have to leave it with that. That's the voice of Dr. Matthew Ellis. He's a professor of oncology at WashU over in St. Louis. We're also joined by Dr. Stephen Kingsmore, director of the Center for Pediatric Genomic Medicine at Children's Mercy. Thank you both for your time today. I sure enjoyed having you.
Thank you, Steve.
Thank you so much.
You can find out more information about our broadcast at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, we'll look at one doctor's view of how children might be over-medicated, and we'll take a stroll through a rustic life spent in a Flint Hills cabin. The show's produced by Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, and Beth Lipoff. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.